it's a perspective that I've been thinking about of, do we actually want the CISO to win? And actually, despite the fact that I'm in security, I would say that's not the state that I think we actually want.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to see you guys, as always. Before we jump in, you know, I was thinking ever since I made that awful prediction about the CrowdStrike price, we don't have to have a feature on it, but it's fun to check in every now and then. I saw this morning it's about $311, so I think it's coming back. Are you guys surprised? Is that in line with what you expected? Mario?
I think if we look back at those episodes, I'm going to take a little credit here, because later on I'm going to have to eat some crow pie. So it looks like we're up. I'm excited. We were able to invest on a down. So.
Oh, so you're in. Okay, good. Yeah. And you're in the green, or you're in the.
Oh, I'm happy. Yeah. I'm not buying all a right. Porsche tomorrow, but I'm happy.
But next week. Sunil, how about you? Expected, exposed?
Did I expect it to go back up? Yes. Have I been tracking it? No. I think there's, I forget the exact quote, but it's from Daniel Kahneman about like the frequency by which there's an inverse correlation in the frequency that you look up stock prices and the actual value of your portfolio or something like that. It was a nifty quote. I can't find it. But anyway, I try not to look at stock prices because it just it makes your day worse. Even if it goes up, you still have these things that go down. You're like, ah. So there's nothing good to be taken from looking at stock prices every day.
Yeah. I do, but it's pure entertainment. I'm able to completely disconnect any emotional response to actual taking action. And I know that's true because I've ridden things to actual zero. I have things in my portfolio that are down 98%, still not selling, just staring at it every day. It's entertainment, but I don't feel compelled to action.
That's called risk aversion.
It must be, or idiocy.
I hate going to Vegas because I hate gambling, and I don't enjoy losing money.
I don't really enjoy either way. I don't enjoy winning either because it's not legit. You know.
But let me offer, some of the best risk professionals are poker players, right? Yeah. They know how to, they understand risk on a play-by-play basis. They understand, or the good ones at least, know how much risk they can take so they can play another day. Yeah. And one of my favorite books is Annie Duke's Thinking and Bets. And Annie Duke is she won the World Series of Poker. But the whole book is really about risk management. And I think it's a really great sort of way to think about security risks because it's a lot of the similar sort of concepts that we all have to deal with on a regular basis as well.
Totally. Like, especially if you're one of those companies that is involved in buying new companies, their services, right? New emergence, new, you know, startups. There's a significant risk with startups, right?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, what we do is risk management. And that's why I bring that up a lot when we talk about things like reporting lines and people get surprised to see someone reporting to a GC. And my argument is that they are a risk manager, 100%. And not only is there a similarity there, but there's parallels in good ones and bad ones. Like bad lawyers aren't managing risk. They're being emotional. They're watching the stock price every day and they're running and hit and click and sell and buy. Right? And those are the lawyers you get that say, we can't put a video screen in the car because we'll get sued, so no. But that's not risk management. Risk management is what is the percentage likelihood someone's going to litigate? What's the average settlement? What's the upside? How does that work out? And then, boom, Tesla's got this TV screen in the center console. Somehow they risk managed it. So, yeah, I think it's totally parallels.
Yeah. Just keep in mind, there is those unexpected ones, too, where the whole risk management decision around the Ford Pinto and where to place the gas tank, they did actually make a decision that, okay, with this event, with this design, we're going to only kill so many people, and that's an acceptable risk decision. And, you know, public opinion would have something different to say about that. But that said, I mean, it was a proper practice of risk management, but didn't quite factor in some additional factors that maybe would have changed that dynamic.
Yeah, some risk appetites have to be binary, like the one for loss of human life.
Yes. Yeah.
You just don't get to do 98% is good on that one. So, we started to get off piece, but we tied it back to security anyway. Going forward, that one of the things that we've chatted about since our last episode was the CISO market, which we are all glad to not care about so much. But I think it's worth keeping your eye on, because if nothing else, when people talk about like ethical quandaries in the CISO position, or what if people aren't willing to do what you asked them to do, and all of that, there's often just go somewhere else. There's a hot market. You could always just, you know, if you're willing to cave and compromise on your morals, then that's ridiculous, because you could have got another job or it's walked. And maybe that's not so true, huh? Mario, have you been doing a little research in this area?
I did. I'm going to have to eat crow pie, because I've been telling everybody on previous episodes, you know, if you don't, you know, if people are making you do this as a CISO, walk away, you'll find a job next day. Don't worry about it. But then I was surprised to hear, getting out of my West Coast cocoon, I went to two conferences in New York this week, and at a Signet conference, I bumped into a lot of colleagues, and we just started talking about the state of CISO opportunities, and lo and behold, I'm like, wow, it's really bad out there. As in, people are waiting for months. Jobs are not as available as they used to be. And I was just really surprised. So then I went and talked to Michael Piacente. He's phenomenal, right? You guys all probably, everybody in the CISO community knows him. Really professional guy, really thoughtful person, has a lot of information in this space. And he confirmed that. He says that this issues with jobs, finding jobs, started happening about two and a half years ago. And then Jerry and I belong to a CISO community, like all of us. And there's about 300 people in that Slack community of CISOs. And so Jerry and I did an informal poll and started asking folks, is this accurate? And sure enough, they agree.
Yeah, I think it's rough out there, and that means, of course, that prices are coming down too.
And I guess in that regard, the price being, of course, the cost for that organization pays for a CISO. If I go back to the risk management conversation that we had earlier, effectively, the CEO or the CFO or whoever is making a financial decision, it's, am I going to gamble on not having a security program / CISO, and maybe lose $3 million, $5 million because of whatever penalties, or I'm going to have to take a known loss of hiring a CISO for some, you know, $500K, whatever it is, how much ever they want to pay, over a certain amount of time, where I might still suffer a compromise. And what's my bet here? Like, what's my expected loss here? Maybe some people are actually making that sort of decision at the end and saying, you know what, I'm going to gamble.
It's the same problem we have with cyber risk quantification. Okay, I'm going to try to draw another metaphor here. May lose it. My problem with CRQ is that we spend all this time saying we need to quantify risk, and the goal of that is to bring something to the board that says we have $2.5 million annual loss expectancy, or $400 million, or whatever it may be, somewhere in the middle. And I think that's not the challenge in quantification. It's not in quantifying the risk. It's in quantifying the ROI on the investments that we make.
Yeah.
Right? Proving a negative. And that's the exact problem with the CISO. It's very hard to say, at the end of the day, what's the difference in my $300,000 CISO and my $700,000 CISO? Is it 2X? And it's arbitrary. And part of the problem, and it's not an individual issue, but in the CISO world, it's like being in 2500 BC in law. You know, we just made this stuff up. So if the three of us individually were all hired at the same firm in sequence, we would each burn down the other's program and take it in a completely bizarre direction and with different vocabulary. There's no, standards. I hate to say that word out loud. So it's hard to measure. But where I think there still is demand is people who say, oh, I'm going to be in a room where if I say I don't have a CISO, I'm going to have a commercial disadvantage, either because they're under high regulation or they have large customer and TPRM pressure or whatever it may be. So that's what's still driving the high end of the market, I believe.
I would agree with that. I mean, that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing with some of the feedback that, that folks were telling us is those highly regulated industries or those software companies or the startup companies that are also involved in managing and protecting whatever, a service that's critical to customers or data that's needs to be protected. That still seems to be getting a lot of attraction and salaries. But, you know, if you think about it, I mean, there's a lot of, when I was talking to CISOs is, you know, there's only five, if you're looking at Fortune 500, there's only really like 500 jobs, right? So, you know, right? I mean, you could be a deputy CISO as well. So don't get me wrong, but the actual global CISO.
Yeah.
And one of the things that also people said is, it's better to be looking for a job when you have a job. I know, it sounds like basic stuff, 101.
Well, in particular, what they were saying is that people won't give anyone a look if they currently are unemployed. Yeah. And just call it out. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's not surprising.
It's a tough job market overall. It's not just with CISOs. But I would also be just surprised by the number of CISOs that are actually actively looking. I remember it was another survey that was done by Ions or someone else, and they had something like 75% of CISOs are looking for a new role, which is just incredible, the number that they had. There's something to be said about, like, is there a reason why this pattern exists over and over again? Is it because of burnout? Is it because we want fresh ideas or fresh perspectives? I'm not sure, but maybe it's just I don't know if there's something systematically wrong with our practice if we see this type of constant movement. It seems like there's it probably is worth looking at why this is happening and if there's some more fundamental structural flaws that need to be reexamined or addressed.
You know what I'm worried about is that when CFOs start making decisions about, well, why am I paying the CISO this money when I could be using the same amount to, you know, buy better software to protect the company or maybe bring in a junior person or, you know, promote someone within. I'm starting to worry that it's a future of our practice that we might see it disappear. I hate to say that. Or merge with the CIOs.
So there are a couple. There are two models I will throw out you guys to consider. And let me challenge Jerry's point earlier around where we are in the evolution of our practice. Okay, so first of all, there's a model called the Cynefin model. It's spelled Cynefin, and it's spelled weird and pronounced weird. But anyway, there's four stages. It goes from chaotic to complex to complicated to clear. Chaotic, complex, complicated, clear, and it cycles in that pattern over and over again. When things are chaotic and complex, you can't really buy a technology to address that. In fact, these are like predicaments that we're in. It's not something you can fix. You just have to manage the risks associated with it. When it moves to complicated and clear, we actually know the solution. It's a matter of doing it. It may be hard initially because it's complicated, but then technology comes in and it becomes very clear. Usually we depend too much on technology for something and it creates a trigger moment where everything's thrown back into chaos. When it comes to security, we've gone through the cycle for different types of things. Do you remember when PKI was being rolled out? That was like very difficult, more on the chaotic, complex side. But eventually it became like super easy and now we have Let's Encrypt and it's just like, you know, stupid easy, right?
Yeah.
MFA would have been the same situation where earlier it was very difficult. Now it's like super easy. And so more and more of our security practices, I don't think it's in the 2500 BC era. I think it's now in the kind of in the modern day where some things are pretty straightforward and easy. Now to Mario's point, more and more businesses are run using technologies for which the practices are already baked in and super clear, right? So what do I need a CISO for? Okay. Where you need a CISO is when things remain chaotic and complex. And if that's this, like, if your business is in that space, like AI, then maybe that's where you know, security people are really needed, because this is whole new ground that we don't really understand yet. Anyway, it's just a it's a model to consider. And then the second model is actually one that I came up with, or at least I thought through, around like what's the future of the CISO look like in terms of its relationship with the CIO. And I have a whole presentation on this called the DIE Triad, but I tracked the history of the CISO and the CISO relationship over the past many decades, where I see this tension increase between the CISO and the CIO because of the type of things that we in the security community tell the CIO to do. And ultimately, the type of recommendations that we used to make early on would really disrupt the environment. It would be very much destabilize it. And so you create this tension between the two. And I would say in the 2010s, we figured out that, you know what, this tension is really not good. We need to, well, the tension's good, but the reporting relationships should be perhaps more separated out. And so we created this separate CISO function that was a dedicated business unit. And it was separate from the CIO. Well, in this narrative I have with the DIE triad, I mentioned that in the 2020s, this separation that we see between the CIO and the CISO, I think there might be a convergence moment in the future, in this era. But the question is, who wins? Like, who does it converge to? Does the CIO win? Does the CISO win? Or is there some new state? And I actually framed it this way, which is there are three possible states. The CISO wins, and this is where everything's secure by design. We make sure everything has all the security principles and security baked in. And how wonderful is that as security practitioners, right? But if we do that, we end up with a very fragile environment. If the CIO wins, then it's what I characterize as a DIE environment. It's a very distributed, immutable, ephemeral. It's a very resilient environment. Actually, that's how I've characterized it, if the CIO wins. But there's a third state that I think we should all strive for, which is a anti-fragile environment. So again, if the CISO wins, it's fragile. If the CIO wins, it's resilient. And if there's a third state, which is to be anti-fragile, it's essentially finding a way to constantly break your environment and rebuild it, refactor it, so that whenever you find something that's fragile, you actually go and rebuild it so that it isn't fragile. Anyway, there's a whole talk I have on this, but it's an interesting perspective. It's a perspective that I've been thinking about of, do we actually want the CISO to win? And actually, despite the fact that I'm in security, I would say that's not the state that I think we actually want.
But I would argue, Sunil, you and Jerry have a really good business acumen, right? You have, as CISOs of these large organizations, you also thought, when you talk about risk, risk has, in my opinion, a little bit, at least in the business world, has a monetary angle to it. Do I put this much money to reduce this risk? And you guys always talk about that. Yeah, Jerry?
It's funny. I was thinking about this morning. I was thinking about cyber risk quantification, because that's the kind of thing that I think about for fun. I heard someone earlier this week talking about CRQ, cyber risk quantification, and they were talking about it in the same conversation as CISOs or security teams need to be able to talk to the board. And they were trying to say, in order to talk to the board, you have to do everything in dollars and cents, as if to imply that that's the only thing that they understand. And I don't think that's true. And I'm remembering sitting in the risk committee of the board of directors of a massive public company, you know, quarter after quarter for many years. And I'd be on the agenda in cybersecurity, and so would the GC to talk about ongoing litigation, right? Litigation risk. And so would the CRO, the chief risk officer, to talk about Brexit in those days, right? Pandemic. Later, any geopolitical events, tariffs, all that stuff came into the into the risk committee meeting. And were all of them on pie charts? Were they all like continuous distributions across metrics? No. And when it came to litigation risk, the GC would say, well, you know, we got those three open things. We got the X lawsuit and the Y, and we have a potential, and we've gotten a letter from them on this. And then the board would ask, well, how's that gone? Any updates? You know, well, we heard from them, and, you know, they're asking for $10 million, but, you know, we've looked. They've tried this a lot. I don't think they're going to prevail personally. I think, you know, when they get below about $2 million, we can probably settle on this. That's the, probably where it's going to end. Or I think our dismissal motion is probably going to prevail, I think. And that was the order of the day. And it was, it's been going on for 100 years of we've had that kind of risk. And the same thing with Brexit. Yeah, if this actually happens, we may, and we don't know, there will be regulatory uncertainty, and we don't know if the UK will fork regulations from the EU or if they'll bring in their own regime, and if so, we need to move our data centers. So we are beginning the exploration phases. No one demanded a precise financial analysis of all this stuff, and it's because it was more binary, you know, and I think that's very true of cyber. So I don't think that we have to put dollars and cents on everything.
So let me offer, perhaps what we're really looking for is not cyber risk quantification, but rather cyber risk translation. What I mean by that is, if your business is in the business of making widgets, and let's say for whatever reason, the widgets are free, okay? I just, you know, whatever, okay, just conceptually. And for whatever reason, these widgets is the unit of measure of some sort, right? Then you'd be talking about it in terms of the cyber risk translation is in terms of widgets, not in terms of dollars or cents, but rather in these widgets. If the business that you're in deals with forest fires, okay, then your cyber risk translation is around how it affects our ability to deal with forest fires. At the end of the day, the reason why I think we picked money was because, well, for one, Jack Jones was from, you know, Nationwide Insurance, and of course they care about money. But not every business thinks that's the, you know, will treat that as the main means to communicate risk. So I think maybe what you're suggesting is, you know, our view should be cyber risk translation into the language that the business understands. And if that happens to be money, so be it. If it doesn't, then pick something else.
And it's certainly not SaaS. It's certainly not, you know, CVEs. Like, I mean, that's where we're falling short. We all should agree that it's right. We've just been too myopic.
I'll tell you the one question I hated, since we're probably the last topic on this. I hated getting in front of the board when it was asked, right? One of the board members, one of the senior executives was, okay, I understand how our security program looks and the health of it, blah, blah, blah. But how do we compare with
benchmark.
Our competitors?
Ugh. That's what they want.
Just like, ugh.
That's the language. Yeah.
Right? That's what they do. That's what business does, right? You want to see how your company is performing. If you're a public company, how you're
performing. Exactly. Right? Because they know that that's the exact topic that the SEC is going to ask when there's some kind of suit for negligence later on. And if they could say, A, we were above board, above par, below par, and B, we actually knew that. That's the outcome that they want.
I think there's another comparison that I would argue is even more important than the external benchmark, which is how does it compare to other types of risk within the organization itself? There's operational risk, there's financial risk, with banks, credit risk, all these other types of risks, right? And let's just, for argument's sake, and let's just use the quantification in dollars and cents. If the cyber risk is 0.00001% of the overall risk, guess what? I'm not investing much in that, right? So I think we can benchmark ourselves with other people, but it should be a little bit easier to benchmark internally with the other types of risks that we face.
I tried, Sunil. That didn't work, bro. I'm just
you try to quantify it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mario, you were in a bad spot. You're like, hey, you really don't want me. This isn't really important. You're like, oh, it's not important. Well, why are we paying? You're like, oh, well, sorry. I meant to say this is really important. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, but tying it back to what the evolution of the CISO thing, Sunil, that you were talking about and the CIO versus CISO thing. I mean, I didn't grow up with the CIO being over the CISO, so I had to kind of like learn that's what the hell everybody was talking about all the time later on. So it wasn't like second nature to me. So that whole concept seems almost invalid. Like, I don't think there's any kind of tension and one will prevail and the other won't. I think the CISO role is a risk manager, and if there's any direction, it's more towards the chief risk officer, and maybe it'll be absorbed into the chief risk officer world. Mm. And CIO has nothing all to do with this, because what we keep on trumpeting is that it's not a technology thing. Mm. It's not just about tech. Mm. Whenever we're not making these damn benchmarks against IT spend that Big Four keeps doing, but the other 99% of the time, they're saying it has nothing to do with IT, and I would agree with that side.
You know, the thing is, it's as you have less, as you go more cloudy, as a company goes more cloudy, and as a company starts embracing more AI, you have less of this infrastructure, et cetera, to support naturally. And so CIOs who apparently focus on budget, managing budgets, I think we all have to manage budgets, but as they have less and less of that infrastructure to manage, then what they're saying is CFOs are going to say, well, one of you guys should be doing this job.
Or where's my savings?
Yeah, that's sure. Right.
Yeah, I agree. All right. I can tell we're not done with that topic, and that's fine. We'll come back to it in future weeks for sure.
Yeah.
Another thing. Somebody brought up a dedicated listener. Said he shared an anecdote, which it was pretty common to me. And he said, you know, a friend of his got an inbound saying, we found a vulnerability. It's really a big deal. But we're not going to tell you unless you pay us. You know, and it made me realize that not everyone is on the same page with regard to what we call like vulnerability disclosure programs, bag bounties, that sort of thing. So, you know, let's start on the most mature end of the spectrum. I'd say a company, I know from experience that if you have a bug bounty program, then you get one of those emails in, you refer it to the bug bounty program, they triage it, and they can tell either, oh yeah, it's a big deal, it's worth it. It would, if they had submitted it through the program, we would have given them $5,000. Would you like to do that? And hopefully you do. Or it's bogus. You know, I mean, it's if we submitted it through the program, we would have rejected it because it's just dumb, like most of them. Or they won't talk to us more without money. We recommend you call the FBI. And those are the three options. But if a company doesn't have a bug bounty program and you get one of those emails, have you been in that situation? And it sounds like all bets are off on how people are going to process that kind of thing.
I know we talked about bug bunnies before, but before bug bunnies, as you know, you're a startup, you know, it's only 50, 60 of you, maybe, bug bunnies are going to cost you on average, maybe 40 to 50,000 to start off, kind of like the baseline. And maybe that's not right. Maybe that's not where you're as a startup, you're going to, necessarily spend your money. You have limited funds at that time. I think one advantage for those small startups is that they don't get noticed a lot unless you're really like the whizzes of the world or something like that, right? But so you know you can kind of go under the radar and maybe you don't need to go and invest in bug bunnies. But there's a point when you start getting more attention that internal, managing this internally by yourself, it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people didn't realize that that's something that they get with a bug bounty is the ability to deal with these random inbound emails.
Yeah.
Well, I've had bug bounty programs, and I still get those random emails as well. But as you pointed out, a lot of them are just like bag bounties. I sometimes I wonder if I can pay them off with all the gift cards that I bought for my CEO. But anyway, that's it. The vast majority of these are again just noise. Like, hey, your DMARC settings are wrong. Yeah, thanks. That's not much of a bounty.
You know, so when I've heard in like Slacks and all that, CISOs talking about it, one thing I'm not comfortable with is people saying that they ignore them or that they don't write them back. And that,
yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot of bad things.
It's true there could be some publicity, bad publicity that could come out of it if it's truly a real issue. But the vast majority of these I've seen are just like just noise. So I don't even bother.
If they send in, okay, so three quick classes, right? If they send in a, hey, there's this clickjacking iframe vulnerability and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, I get it. That's stupid. I'm not writing you back because I know you just sent that email 6 million times too. And then, or if it says, we have something really important, it's a really big vulnerability, those we had to write back because, I mean, I don't know if it's directly been translated into legal requirements, but I know we had a lot of regulation about customer complaints. And as a public company, if you have a something that needs to go to the, that says they want to talk to the board, you got to route it to the board. That's part of law. And if you get an email in that says, we know something really bad, even if it's a 1% chance it's true, you're going to have a big problem if you didn't write it back. And so we would write them back, and 90% of the time it was a vendor trying to sell something, and we would just lambaste them with fire. I mean, we'd bring in the, we only wrote you back because it's legal compunction, and you're abusing that now. But it didn't burn a lot of cycles to be able to do that. I think you have to.
Well, one of the things I think we can talk about a little later is what are security assumptions that we make that operate at human scale that are that are completely rendered no longer valid when we have machine scale tools or machine scale mechanisms.
Yep.
And bug bounty is one of those.
Yep.
Okay. I can give you some other ones, like for example, open source, and you know, are all bugs being shallow with enough eyes versus closed source. If we have machine eyes, is closed source potentially better?
That's a very good point, Sunil. That's a very good point.
So in the same way, we have these bug bounties. They currently operate at a human scale, but now imagine you have, we've seen this before, where someone uses ChatGPT to find a vulnerability, and it's really not a legit vulnerability, but imagine now someone just cranks these out on a regular basis. So that's a case where our human scale assumptions no longer apply, and we need to really rethink the whole thing.
I just solved it while you're talking. Ready?
You sold it.
I got this.
All right. Go for it.
I was about to mention, before you brought that up, security.txt. Okay, right? So for listeners who aren't familiar with that, there's a standard. It's an RFC. If you put a stroke security.txt after your domain name, there's a nice little format, usually be an ASCII file, and it has like some key value pairs. It requires some and by the RFC, and I never follow it because I don't agree with that. Like, for example, a PGP key. Awful. Mm-hmm. Awful. Last thing I want is some stupid symmetrically encrypted or asymmetrically encrypted crap. But anyway, what you can put in there is here's an email address that you could write to if you have a bug.
Yeah.
And you could put a URL to something like a vulnerability disclosure program.
Yeah.
And there's some really easy free examples, and I think every company should have that.
Yeah.
I think you should have a page where you could submit it. I think you should not allow attachments. There's no need. Someone can say everything they need in words, and if they demand saying attachment, it's creepy, and I don't want to take attachments from these people. there's no need for it at all.
Or accept links, right? It could be used as a phishing attack against some of your own security.
Yeah, exactly.
People.
Very plain. You could just give me Morse code, you could tell me what enough to convince me to get on the phone, and then we'll figure out the detail. But to Sunil's point, so that's what I was going to say before. After what you just said, Sunil, and by the way, I know a really prime example of that, and I've never really spoken about this one publicly. Let's see if it goes anywhere. GDPR, right? The right to be forgotten and the right to request an iteration of all the data that you have on that somebody has on you. You can go to Starbucks and demand that they show you a report, and they will do it. It is extraordinarily expensive for them. I mean, just being in business, I know that request is a massive pain in the ass. What if they got 2 million of them tomorrow? GDPR DOS. I've always said, and that's going to prove it untenable, right? However, I can't solve that problem. But on the VDP submissions, again, security.txt, all we need is another one, update the RFC for an API endpoint. Here's our schema. Here's how you submit these in bulk. And you have to conform to that. And that's what we'll have to do if you start getting to where you're getting 100 of these things a day. And then you can put on your own AI on actually triaging them.
A minimum. I agree. I like it. I'm buying it.
All right.
But a minimum. Look, I think even if you're not using a bug bounty program, you hire some bug bounty program company, at minimum, even if you're a small company or small startup, you should have a page like you said, Jerry, and I think you're saying the same thing, Sunil, that says, hey, if you find a bug or a security issue with whatever X, here's the email, please send it to us and describe what you're going to ask from them, right? No attachments, we only accept texts. I think that's the minimum you could do. Now on the AI idea, Sunil, it's brilliant, right? We should be using some sort of, maybe, I think that's what you're trying to say, some sort of model that can read that stuff, crunch through it, and make decisions on it, and highlight the real things. Sunil, is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if it's just purely a technology solution. I think there are some process elements that need to also be considered too. Or like even some fundamental, re-examining of assumptions. I mentioned the open source example where we assume open source is more secure because we have more eyeballs on it. But is that assumption still correct in the world of machine eyeballs? I'll give you another example. I saw this article the other day too around being able to extract data from just video screens, right? So I'm sure Jerry knows this too. Large financial institution, DLP is a really big concern, but we generally wrote off the ability for people to, screen grab and whatever, because we just had...
With their phone, especially.
Yeah, with their phone, just because we're like, you know, the volume through it is just not big enough that we are going to care, right? But now... There was an Ars Technica article yesterday or the other day about someone just basically video scraping everything. And you can imagine now that's, you know, data exfil at scale, because it's machine scale, not human scale anymore. So what assumptions do we make, risk management assumptions do we make that are now invalidated because we can do machine scale things?
Yeah,
I have a really cool security story that's very related to that. So it must have been, 2021 or something like that. And we were members of the ARC. You might have been then, Sunil, too. Bank of America would have been. So critical infrastructure entities. And we didn't by law get any privileged access to things. But if somebody knew something that was a really big deal and they wanted to tell the most important people first, then they would engage with that community. And that happened with Mandiant, right? And Kevin Mandiant specifically. They were... going to let us know about a pressing vulnerability and some info about it while it was embargoed, before it was out to the public. And so we got together on the secure briefing, and he was literally doing the briefing. I don't know if he was sharing his own screen, but there was a screen up there. And it was basically like, hey, this is just a draft. We're still working on it. It's not done. We expect it to be embargoed through date X, let's say 7 days from now. But look, and I love Kevin. He's just awesome. So as usual, he was very candid. And he said, but who knows, you know, someone might go public with this tonight, and if so, it's going to come out fast, so don't hold me to it. But, you know, if we have our druthers, it's going to be 7 days, give you a chance to check your systems, all that. And it was a zero day, right? We could argue about the definition of that, but this one was in there for sure. And in the slides he was going through, which was a draft, now this was, I guess it was Zoom, it might have been WebEx back then. And as he was showing it, he was showing some kind of IOCs that were associated with it. And this is one of the few times in the world that IOCs matter, because there was embargoed, nobody had talked about it yet. And here's IP addresses that are actually interrogating for it. And he was screen sharing, so he wasn't ready to show, to share XML or whatever of the IP addresses. And he didn't expect, and we didn't talk about it, but maybe he didn't even want people to start doing anything with these IP addresses. I was running Polarity. You guys may remember Polarity, right? And full disclosure, investor in Polarity, it was recently sold to Threat Connect. So I don't know if that absolves me of that disclosure anymore or not. But anyway, so Polarity, OCR, looking at your screen the entire time, looking for characters that meet certain regular expressions, including IP addresses. And we had a really great integration with Polarity. So literally, while he screen shares, the IP address shows in Zoom or at Meet or WebEx, and my Polarity client sees it, normalizes it, shoots it to our APIs, and scans through all of our systems to see if we've had any touches from that, because that's just how we had it all configured. And I don't remember if we did or we didn't at the time, but that's to your very point. Here he is embargoed, trying to just tease with it,
damn,
and I didn't have any
cool
choice in the matter. I ran the thing, even though I didn't even, I kind of wanted to. It was great. Yeah.
That's
but I
cool.
did the same thing with vendors showing me BitSight reports.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let me have them because you have to talk to BitSight and get marketed to if you want to actually see what Wells Fargo is complaining about. And so they're doing a screen share because that's all they could show us about the report. And I'm in real time as the CISO of the organization saying, oh, that IP address used to belong to a subsidiary that we bought. We dissolved that. And I think, how the hell does this guy know this stuff?
Don't get me started with BitSight. I'll tell you one thing. I used to be, when I was a CISO at a company that was a competitor of AWS. And, you know, we would have these website where we say, please, if you have any vulnerabilities to find, here's an email. And what we found was that either we were getting flooded with spam, or attackers were trying to overwhelm maybe our security ticketing system. So we had like a ticketing system. Most of these stuff, when you have the security emails, you know, if the more quote unquote advanced companies will generate a ticket, a case number. And what we were finding out is that we're overwhelming our, because what is, you know, most of us have security at xcompany.com or support security at whatever. Well, whatever that is, these guys could, you know, they're not dumb. They're like, oh, that must be some ticketing system, maybe even used by the security team. Let's go flood them and then run another attack. And so that's what we
experienced. You have to do a recapture. Mm-hmm. You have to do a recapture on all these forms now. And
yeah.
And by the way, sorry, all day anecdotes here. I remember once, so we all deal with this as a whole episode in itself of when you run scans and the devs get upset. Right?
Oh, yeah, I did that all the time.
yeah, and you're like, I want to be nice. I want to be sympathetic. But at the end of the day, you should come to me with embarrassment. Like, hey, look, I know this is embarrassing. It's stupid that my app doesn't handle it. I know. I'm going to fix it. But can you give me like 6 hours, please? That's the right conversation. Not, you can't scan. It makes production go down. Yeah, like, yeah. Okay, maybe that's not the problem. But I remember one where every 404 error emailed the developers.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just wanted to know if they had a bad link, and they never did. And then, boom, someone hit it with, like, Acunetics, or maybe it was us hitting it with whatever.
Tenable. Nessus. The old Nessus.
2,000 or 3,000 404s in a row.
Open, and
of course, it was security needs to stop. They're destroying the business.
Yeah.
I mean, you think?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about encryption for a minute. I hate encryption almost as much as cyber risk quantification. It's a tie. So supposedly someone might have finally had a practical use for quantum in the encryption realm. Am I understanding that right? Have you guys dug into this story?
I did, actually. So first of all, the actual paper itself is mostly written in Chinese, so I can't read it. I'm not Chinese, and I can't even read it. I suppose I could have thrown it into ChatGPT or something and said, hey, go translate this for me. Two, this is somewhat ancillary, but I just thought it was kind of odd. It was hosted on an HTTP website.
I didn't know you could do that anymore. If it was even
possible. Yeah. I'm like, so it's cool. I just thought it was kind of odd.
That's phenomenal.
Paper on encryption. But yes, exactly. It's like it was completely unencrypted. I mean, you know, not that there's anything necessarily that needs to be secured, but still.
That's
like,
my whole point. But go on.
Default, right? Okay. All right. Okay. All that said. Yeah, there's again, I can't read Chinese. So I don't know what that actually said, but I think there's a lot of questions about the claims here, because I mean it's a pretty significant claim. And if it's what is it? They say you know, the bigger the claim, the more evidence you really need to show, right? And so if that's the case, then I'm not sure if I can see the evidence. I'm just looking at, for example, the Chinese. And I'm looking for like numbers. I'm looking for something that can help me pick out, like, you know, what was the entropy on the keys that they used? How many qubits were they using? Maybe they wrote it in Chinese, spelled it. I couldn't see those things, and it was hard. Like, what versions of the libraries are they using? What OpenSSL libraries were they using? That kind of stuff wasn't very clear.
Or academic rigor.
Yeah, yeah. So if you make bold claims, you should come with, you know, like, substantive evidence, and maybe it was in Chinese, I couldn't read it, so being able to know that this was an authentic claim is to be seen. Okay. But that said, let me also just throw out there, I remember we did this way back during FSISAC days, but we were trying to figure out how much lead time did we have to be able to be ready for quantum. And I think at the time it was like if we started today, like if we started to change out our crypto today, it would take us like, I don't know, something like 15 to 20 years to fully swap out our crypto. So we better get started now. This was kind of the point that was made. But I think it pointed to a much bigger concern or issue, which is it doesn't really matter about quantum. What really matters is our ability to swap out crypto, right?
Agility. Remediation
and so crypto
agility.
Yeah, that was the key sort of recommendation. How do we increase crypto agility? Quantum just happens to be like the more earthquake, you know, massive sort of concern. But we've had cryptographic failures constantly. So being able to swap out crypto is something that we should all be able to do now.
We're talking about this topic, and I thought we were going to talk about it. I thought about forward secrecy, and I was like, you know how forward secrecy is supposed to be, I don't know if it's bulletproof against quantum computing, but it does help. Can you guys do a little poll here? How many of you guys have ever accomplished forward secrecy in your company? Because I have not.
Well, I mean, have you implemented like TLS 1.3, or is that part of the question?
Yeah, well, is 1.3, is TLS 1.3, does it have forward secrecy already built into it? I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, perfect forward secrecy is built into 1.3, TLS 1.3. I forget if it's part of 1.2, but I'm pretty sure it's part of 1.3. So
I didn't say it in 1.2.
The question is, if the question is, have we implemented 1.3, you'll see right now many standards basically say, we support, if you're at 1.2, you're good, okay? We're not expecting people to get to 1.3 just yet. So I think that's kind of your answer, which is, there's a lot of reasons why it's still hard to do 1.3. Is the juice worth the squeeze and whatever disruption you might otherwise face?
I remember when we had to go from P's to your point. I did not know about TLS 1.3, so I learned something new today. I remember when we had to go from TLS 1.1 to 1.2 as PCI, and it was so freaking difficult to do. And it wasn't like, this was not a technical problem, honestly. It always goes back to some process. I think we've talked about this before. Some broken process. Yeah, Sunil?
Well, I was going to say, going back to the Kinefin model I mentioned earlier, you know, swapping out crypto was very either complex or very complicated. But I would say to be ready for quantum, we as an industry need to get quicker, faster and faster to that clear stage where it's just so easy, automated. You just press a button and boom, your crypto is swapped out.
Yeah, I agree. But I think it's a mess out there. Like, first of all, let's talk about what happens if the current state of the art in crypto becomes completely crackable by those with the quantum rig, right? So maybe it takes a big bank 20 years to change out all their ciphers. 90% of those are stupid. Who cares? You want agility? Turn off the crypto. It's all that encryption at rest garbage that we capitulated to because we didn't understand it and the regs said so. So if your encryption at rest on your laptops or something, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, what's the doomsday scenario here?
Wait a minute. You were used to work at the ICE. Now I'm gonna get a little emotional here, a little, you know, adversarial. There's this thing in this whole exchange industry for the, you know, New York Stock Exchange and all these other exchanges called Rich SCI. And you have to maintain freaking even emails for more than, what is it, 5-7 years? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but that's not encryption.
I know that's not encryption, but you have to hold it, and you're going to have to encrypt it, okay, folks? Because it's part of Rich SCI. You have to protect that information. So now, right? See,
I'm saying it's totally bogus. I mean, encryption at rest, whether you have it or not, you always have to go check. Why? Because it doesn't make a difference. Because when you go to get the data, it decrypts it for you. So it doesn't really, like, what's the threat model? Which consumers of the bank are going to lose their money, and how? Give me that.
Why do we create this Rich SCI thing anyway to begin with? What's the premises, Jerry? Help me understand.
It's completely unrelated to that. It's more about supposedly making sure that financial markets are sound and orderly, and there's not going to be chaos in them because of operational disruption. The 5-year retention thing is actually SEC public companies. It's not in Reg SCI.
I would say, Mario, that the perspective to consider is, some of these things are good practices, but there are better practices. And sometimes we treat good practices as best practices and not expecting anything better. But there are actually better practices because we learn and we get better.
Yeah, I think the big problem, though, for somebody who's on the other, who's not in the, who has to comply with this regulation, the thing that was really cumbersome were where you have to one, save the email, even if the email has nothing to do with a financial transactions. We're just talking. I'm just your vendor, but if you are part of that rich SCI mafia, I have to make sure I collect all those emails. Or what about the CRM problem? Right now, do I have to do a CRM for all my clients, or then I have to identify? Oh, in my CRM, these customers are rich SCI customers. I got to grab that data and put all that information somewhere. Oh, yeah, it gets really wicked. And you guys are the ones driving it. You guys drove that. And not you, Jerry, were just specifically.
You were getting bad lawyers that were just being lazy. Hey, but back to that security. Sorry, that encryption thing, though. What was really funny about all those, like you guys were just talking about, I forget the word you use. Oh, supporting new and swapping out ciphers or TLS versions and all of that. Going from 1.1 to 1.2 was never remotely hard. It was just literally one click. The thing that was painful was turning off 1.1. It was deprecating the old use. And the ironic thing was that Sunil was coming along. I see I'm never going to let you off the hook for working at Bank of America. So Sunil's coming along over in the regime of Bank of America and saying, well, I won't do business with you, Mario, because you would allow me to negotiate 1.1. And you would never have the gall to turn to him and say, why the hell would you negotiate 1.1, Sunil? I thought you had your crap together. Why don't you just we allow 1.2? It's on you. If you're running 1.1, that's totally you. You know? And in practice, I mean, we literally had Wells Fargo out of both sides of their mouth saying that they demanded we shut off the ability to support an old cipher and telling us we couldn't shut off the cipher because they couldn't upgrade their browser at the same time. Yeah. So let's say we went from TLS 1.2 to TLS 0, turned it all off. My point is nobody's willing to talk about what that does. So I'm at home. I'm logging into my bank account through AT&T. I'm kind of counting on them being fairly secure, and it's going over. I mean, can the PLA capture that? Mm. Yeah, probably.
They can
capture a lot of stuff.
If you saw the article
the NSA
about
too.
Yes.
And everyone in between. Yeah, so they'd be able to get to. Are they going to log in and do some ACH fraud and all that? The people that were worried about doing ACH fraud, nothing moves. The puck doesn't move at all with encryption up and down. No one's capturing ciphertext in organized crime, waiting to run brute force cracks and hoping that credentials from 2.5 years ago will let them log in and get some money out to gift cards. Like, what are we talking about here? It's not doomsday.
Well, I mean, I wanted, and Sunil, you actually poked at this particular so-called researcher and questioned the value of this research, if it's really, is it really legit? And I'm just trying to figure out what are they trying to do? Again, my conspiracy, right? What the heck are these guys trying to get? Like, people visit
them? Clicks and likes.
Right?
Clicks and likes, that's all.
Because it is kind of scary. I think it is kind of it's going to be scary to encrypt and decrypt. Oh, maybe not. Maybe I'm being over. I need to think about it a lot more. But I think given my experience with TLS 1.1 and 1.2, that was really painful. And if this is
by the way, even for big banks, the stuff that matters, the forward internet facing, it's all on CDNs these days.
Yeah.
And so all you have to do is take the Akamai or the Cloudflare or the Fastly and say, oh, we want to also support TLS 1.5. And they handle everything for you. The long tail is all those internal systems that probably shouldn't be encrypted, internal networks.
It's the storage stuff you have. If you're storing these files, that's what I worry about. Not the TLS communication per se, but the actual storage of the data.
The assumption that the ciphertext is all in enemy hands is just a pretty bold assumption. And I don't think that's always true. No. All right. Anything else you guys want to add on and pile on to the TLS bandwagon?
Well, as far as the quantum bandwagon is concerned, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be ready for it. I think there are just, again, nearer term things that we can be ready for that will prepare us for quantum whenever that hits. Will this occur at some point? Yes. I think, I strongly believe that we'll get to a point where quantum computers are practicable and can do things that are being claimed. Did it happen today? Doubtful, but will it happen? Yes, we just don't know quite when. And the best way to prepare is to have, again, just greater agility.
It's kind of like when I know I'm going to die one day, so I just don't know when. But I know it's going to happen, unfortunately.
But you can be prepared, right?
I can be prepared.
You know how to prepare. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well. Thanks, guys. It was fun as always. I think we've got a ton of material, and we could do this every day if we had the time. But I'm looking forward to the next one already, and I hope that you guys have a good week.